Thanks very much, Donnelly. Can everybody hear me? Is the line on? Good. Okay. Thanks very much for the invitation to be here. It's a great pleasure to be here, but to see everybody and to honor Jerry in this way. What I want to do today is talk about some recent work that I've been doing on gradient flows, dissipation, and double brackets, and so on. This is related to a little bit to what you saw from Juan Pablo Ortega yesterday. You saw those double brackets and these stochastic differential equations. This goes back to work that I did with Tudor a long time ago, for example, on the coda and gradient flows. There have been some recent interesting extensions, I think, that we've been doing to flows on loop groups, metriplectic flows, which were popularized by Phil Morrison, and so on. The history, in fact, goes back in a nice way to work that I did with Jerry a long time ago. One of the key things that plays a role here is modified Poisson brackets. Modified Poisson brackets originally played a role in some of the very first work that I did with Jerry when we were looking at stabilization of the rigid body. We were looking at how you could find an energy function and a momentum function for the controlled rigid body. We were able to show that if you looked at a modified energy where you had some sort of control and looked again at a modified bracket, the whole system could still remain Hamiltonian. In fact, this was related to the earlier work of Christopher Sudd that I mentioned yesterday on the so-called dual spin satellite, where you had an actual control which kept a wheel spinning at a certain rate. And because there was some sort of feedback that kept it at this rate, it's a controlled feedback system that nonetheless was Hamiltonian. And this work was later picked up, as I mentioned yesterday, by Darrell and some work with Jerry on the rotor and the pendulum. And some of that appears in the book of Marsden and Ratiu, I think. The other interesting connection, which I'll come back to, is on dissipation, in the sense that you saw yesterday. So I worked with Krishna and Jerry and Tudor on Hamiltonian systems where you have a certain kind of dissipation that preserves the adjoint orbit. And again, this is related, in particular, for example, to the metriplectic flows, which I'll discuss in a while. Okay, so let me just show you some of the sort of structures that come up here. So the first thing I want to do is start with the coda flow, which, of course, is a fascinating flow for various reasons, and we're still working on this with Tudor and Francois. So the first equation there is just the coda lattice flow in its general sense. So here, X is some sort of matrix. You can think of it as generally a symmetric matrix with various forms of this. Pi S is the skew symmetric part of X. And this is a beautiful integrable flow, even when X is a full matrix, but in particular when X is a tridiagonal matrix. And I'll come back to that in a moment. And the nice thing about the coda flow is it exhibits a kind of dual Hamiltonian gradient structure. And it's sort of like a starting point for many of the ideas that I'll discuss. In particular, it can be written in this double bracket form, and the related double bracket form is the matrix P over there, which is actually a projection matrix. So you can think of it actually as a flow on symmetric matrices, but also, in fact, as a flow on projective space. So here are a few PDEs, actually, which arise in interesting ways. So these are also sort of gradient-like, it turns out. So one of them is a heat equation. And if I have time, I'll show you how you get that as a kind of gradient flow on a suitable space. A related flow is the scalar flow that I've written down there, which arises from gradient flows on loop groups. And finally, if I have time, this is the so-called dispersionist coda lattice flow. X here is a function, and this is the standard Poisson bracket. And this is a sort of generalization of the coda flow where you let the lattice spacing go to zero. And I'll say something about that in a moment. All right, so let's just begin with the coda lattice flow, as somehow this was the inspiration for all of this. So the coda lattice flow is a canonical Hamiltonian system, if you like, in the first instance, that describes a bunch of particles moving on the line. Or there are other sort of generalizations. You think of particles moving on the line. There's a periodic version where particles are moving on the circle. In particular, what I want to look at here is the version popularized by Moser, where it's a finite set of particles on the line in a way that I'll show you in a moment. So the Hamiltonian is just a canonical Hamiltonian in the variables y and x here. There's an exponential potential which represents nearest neighbor interaction. The associated Hamiltonians look like this. And we're going to choose this convention that e to the x0 minus x1 and e to the xn minus xn plus 1 equals 0. This is the rather brilliant idea that Moser had in his original paper, and it corresponds formally to setting, if you like, x0 minus infinity and x0 plus 1 equals plus infinity. So you put one particle far on the left, another particle far on the right. So you really think of it on the line, but you sort of compactify it in some sense. And that compactification is really important for us. I mean, that's what makes the whole thing, the sort of gradient-like thing, work. But the actual behavior of the flow, in fact, is that you get this bunch of particles in the line, so they all have equal mass. They're moving on the line, and they sort of sort themselves out. So you can think of them as sort of interacting together, and the fastest particle eventually wins and shoots off to infinity. So that's it on the line, but we sort of can compactify it so it doesn't quite go off to infinity, and it goes off to a specific equilibrium. So there are all sorts of things you can say about it. As I say, it has an amazingly rich structure. One way to see this is to make this lovely change of variables, use a Hermann flasker, and in which case, the equations take this form here in the variables a, k, and bk, but in particular, it actually becomes a lattice pair flow. So it's something of the form L dot equals B bracket L, BL minus LB, where L and B are these tridiagonal matrices, and in particular, L is a Jacobi matrix. It has B's on the diagonal, A's on the off-diagonal, and the A's are actually positive because they come from the exponential. So A is really, you can think of A as really representing the potential, e to the x minus xk minus xk plus 1, and B's are just essentially the velocities. And, one of the classic ways of seeing a system as integrable is writing it in this lattice pair form. And one of the immediate things you can see, in fact, is that the flow is isospectral. It preserves the spectrum of L, and in particular, it preserves the traces of the powers of L. So trace L squared, and so on are all conserved. And that's enough, in fact, to show this is integrable. And you can see this is a system on a 2n minus 2-dimensional space, because the trace of these b's is equal to a constant. And traces of the powers are enough integral to show the system is completely integrable. If you look at the full coda, well, you need a whole lot of more integrals. But in fact, it turns out still to be integral, even if I have a full symmetric matrix here. But you need other integrals not coming from the trace. So more than that, though, so it's sort of integrable, but it has all sorts of nice behaviors. So this is the non-periodic total lattice, and it behaves in a really fascinating non-periodic way. And, in some sense, this is originally due to time, so in fact, showed the time one map of this thing is actually just equal to the QR algorithm. And so the QR algorithm is an algorithm for diagonalizing symmetric matrices, and this flow, in fact, diagonalizes symmetric matrices. And one way to see that is to rewrite it in this form L dot equals L bracket N, so this double bracket form. And the matrix L bracket N here is literally just the matrix B. You can just check that if you want to get that B matrix, which is the matrix zero on the diagonals, positive A's, negative A's on the lower, L bracket N with N equals 1, 2, 3, and so on through to N is exactly equal to B. So in fact, this has this kind of dual nature, as I mentioned. It's not only Hamiltonian, but it's also gradient. And so how can it be both? Well, it's a gradient flow on the level set of the integral. So this thing is preserving the traces of the powers of L, and on that level set of the integral is literally a gradient flow. And, well, there are a number of nice things you can say about it. In particular, though, it's easy to show that it sort of flows downhill to a diagonal matrix, and on that diagonal matrix are literally the eigenvalues of L. So it diagonalizes L. And if you take the full version of this, you just take L to be a symmetric matrix, you can check that there's a rather beautiful structure. They're actually n factorial equilibria corresponding to the various permutations of the eigenvalues of L. And the way to see that basically is it's an isospectral flow, so the spectrum is certainly preserved. And since n is a diagonal matrix, you can check that the only equilibria of the system are when L and n commute. So it has to be diagonal. Preserve the spectrum, the only possible equilibria are these permutations of the eigenvalues. So it has all these other equilibria which are kind of interesting, but the one we're sort of interested in, the stable equilibrium, is where all the eigenvalues are sorted. And that's sort of really the connection with the QR algorithm. And I should say also, by the way, that this is sort of the SLN coda. It generalizes in a beautiful way to other Lie algebras. So it sort of has a natural Lie algebra structure, and there are other versions for any reasonable Lie algebra. Yeah. Yes, so you can think about it. I'll say something about it in a moment, actually. So just let me show you sort of a picture. So here's the four-dimensional one. So here's the Hamiltonian. These are the equations of motion in this case. And you can actually just look at the flow of the diagonal entries. It's a little hard to see here because it actually starts a little quickly. But so wherever you start, and they just sort each other out, and it sort of heads off the equilibria to the in this case the sorted eigenvalues of the matrix L. So it actually works. It's very robust. And sort of related to Daryl's question, in fact. So there are two things here. First of all, you can show, you know, since the eigenvalues are preserved. You can think of those in some sense naturally as the action variables. So if you're going to change the action angle variables, one thing you might do is change to the eigenvalues lambda 1, 2 to lambda n, and then need a canonical set of angle variables. And the angle variables, even though it's non-periodic, essentially the angle variables in this case turn out to be the top components of the normalized eigenvectors. And since the eigenvalues are preserved, you can actually think of the flow as flowing on the top components of the normalized eigenvectors. And the nicest way to see that is for P equals RR transpose, which is a rank 1 matrix, which you can think of as being an RP1. And that flow turns out to be exactly equivalent to the original double bracket flow. And it produces the flow that Moser wrote down in his 1974 paper, but not in this form. And the other nice thing about this, and this goes back to the work that I did with Tudor and Roger, is that that there's a beautiful map, that the momentum map from the torus action, and what you can do is you can map the system into a simplex simply by mapping the diagonal entries onto Rn. So if I take the map, which takes the diagonal entries of the matrix L onto Rn, it turns out that what you get is a simplex that looks like this, and what the simplex represents, so if this is the 3x3 case, you can think of each permutation of the eigenvalues as being one vertex of the simplex. And so you take the permutations of the eigenvalues in R2, and you take a convex hull, you get this hexagon, and the flow of the TODA system is actually inside the interior of this polytope. So there's one stable equilibrium, the ordered eigenvalues, and all the other sort of permutations are each at the vertex, and the flow flows down. And I call this the Schur-Horn polytope. And so this goes back to the famous theorem of Schur-Horn, which basically says that if you take, you know, if you have a symmetric matrix, you look at the eigenvalues and you take the convex hull of their permutations, then the diagonal entries of the matrix lie inside that polytope. And in fact, you can show that map is onto. So that's the Schur-Horn theorem. And it has a sort of wonderful generalization to the convexity of the moment map due to Atiyah and Gilliman and Sternberg. So that's the flow, and it has, yeah. Yes. Yes. So yeah, I guess I should have mentioned that. So. Oh, I see. The question is, where does the function that gives the gradient flow? So there are two functions here, so I sort of skipped over that. So the Hamiltonian, so H in this case is just trace L squared over 2, a quadratic Hamiltonian. So this is the Hamiltonian of TODA. The function that gives the gradient flow is, let's call it V equals trace Ln. Okay? So this is a, and if you look at the gradient, so... So if you take if you take trace Ln and you take a suitable metric, and I'll come back to this actually, so you need what's the so-called normal metrics. I'll show this in a moment actually, sort of more generally. If you take this normal metric, you get the flow L dot equals L bracket n. It looks like that. And then if you think of the matrix L like this, with entries B1 through to Bn, and so I just map this to B1 through to Bn, okay, that's the map to Rn. I just follow the diagonal entries of this, and then eventually it'll flow to the eigen. So eventually it'll flow to lambda 1 through to lambda n, sort of ordered, which is one of these vertices. So the math is, it's a really simple math. It's literally just projection, if you like, onto the eigenvalues. At least onto the diagonal entries. So it's actually I mean, you can think of this as actually sort of, you can think of this as a Morse function. It has all sorts of nice properties. So it actually turns out to be a function of the diagonal end. So it's trace Ln. Yeah. So you can think of it as sigma bi, then bini. Yeah. And it has, actually, the way you can think about it, so I wasn't going to say too much about this, but you can think of this as a linear functional on the entries bi. So it's actually doing sort of linear programming. It actually goes back to the so-called Littlewood-Hardy inequality. So what you're trying to do is maximize or minimize this function, subject being on the polytope. It's a linear programming problem. And if you think about it, so what it tries to, if you want to maximize this function given the ni's, what you want to do is put the biggest bi with the biggest ni. That's what it essentially tries to do. And so if you choose ni equals 1, so on through to n, it'll put the smallest bi, you know, with this 1, and the biggest with n, and so on. And if you sort of get away from Toda and you just look at the general matrix, if you choose any ordering you like, you can get it to flow to any of these vertices by choosing the right end. I want to say something about the gradient flow. Now I'm just going to look at just forgetting about Toda for the moment, although you can keep it in the back of your mind. Just let's think of gradient flows on adjoint orbits of the Lie group. So I simply think of an orbit now. So I can think of it as an adjoint orbit, so theta transpose, so L0 theta. And I want to think of exactly the function I just discussed, say trace Ln. And I want to see what sort of gradient I get by choosing the right metric. So in fact, what you can show is if you choose the so-called normal metric, which has come up a couple of times in this conference, then the gradient flow turns out to be something of this double bracket form. So this is the gradient. So let me just write down the metric for you. So there's a natural pairing on the algebra, which is the trace, but in general just the Killing form. So GU here is just the compact part of the Lie algebra. I can decompose it into a part GU super L and GU sub L. So GUL here is the centralizer of L, and GUL is the image under add L. So I just sort of take these two pieces, I decompose the algebra, and then the metric has this rather beautiful form. So tangent vectors to the orbit are just of the form L bracket X and L bracket Y. So it's sort of easy to see that, right? So if I just think of theta as being e to the TL, and I just differentiate with respect to T, then a tangent vector to the orbit is just a bracket. It's L bracket something. Or e to the TX in this case. Yeah, thanks. So e to the TX, right. And then, So any two tangent vectors are of the form either L bracket X and L bracket Y, given X and Y. And now I just want to pair them together in a good way. And the pairing I've written as XL, YL, and that's just taking the part of X in the image of add L. And the reason for that is you don't care about the part that commutes with X, basically. So it defines it uniquely. And this is sort of the moral equivalent of the Kostin-Kirillov symplectic form. If I do a Kostin-Kirillov, I have trace of L X bracket Y, which of course is skew, and this is the natural symmetric version of that. So it's really the natural counterpart of that. And then if you want to compute the gradient, you just compute. And it turns out that the analog of trace LLN in general is kappa of L bracket N. And if you just make this computation with respect to the normal metric, you find out that you get the flow x dot equals x bracket or L bracket N. And that's the computation. So you just differentiate along vectors on the orbit, and it sort of pops out. So that's the flow. So grad H is equal to L bracket N. And as I said, you can make all sorts of choices if you like. And one of them will yield the parallel lattice flow. You can think of other choices, and you can think of other spaces as well. And I'll come back to that. So one of the things that's sort of interesting about these orbits, though, is that's not the unique metric. There are other natural metrics on the orbit. And it's sort of fun to think about those. So I just want to mention the other sort of natural metrics. So one of them is a so-called induced metric. So one thing you could have done, instead of, say, taking x super L and y super L, is just literally pair the brackets together. So trace x bracket L, L bracket x, and L bracket y. That's the so-called induced metric. There's the normal metric, which you just described. So I'll call the natural metric, say, B, the normal metric B1. And finally, you can actually think of, if you identify the adjoint orbit with a coadjoint orbit, it's a natural Kähler manifold, and it defines a Kähler metric, which you can call here B2. So there are actually three metrics lying around, the normal metric, the induced metric, and this Kähler metric. And the Kähler metric, in fact, is the hardest one to write down. So if you think about it in terms of these of operators, at least of vectors to the space, you can think of the induced metric as just trace AB. You can think of B1 as trace AL and BL. And B2 is essentially the square root of this guy in a specific sense. It's a little hard to write down. So in other words, if I think of B1 and B2 in terms of self-adjoint operators, A1 and A2, A1 is equal to A2 squared. So I won't worry too much about the Kähler metric for the moment, but it'll come back. So these three metrics, in fact, are described very nicely in a Tia's original paper on convexity, and they're sort of interesting to think about. So what I want to do now is sort of generalize this to an infinite dimensional setting. So what I want to think about for the moment, which is sort of fun, is the loop group of the circle. So this is a sort of interesting infinite dimensional loop group. So these were popularized by Atiyah and Presley a while back. And the nice thing about loop groups is they behave very similarly to finite dimensional Lie groups. Even though they're infinite dimensional, the loop group itself behaves in some sense like the orbit of the group. So it's a very sort of nice geometrical object. And you might wonder about what sort of gradient flows that you get on this thing, since it behaves like these. It behaves a bit like the finite dimensional flows with these various metrics. So the question is, what do the sort of metrics look like on the loop group? What flows do you get? Do you get interesting PDEs? And this is sort of related to work that I did earlier with Tudor and Herman on flows on the diffeomorphism group, which are also interesting. And if I have time, I'll say something about that as well. So here is the loop group. I'll call it L tilde of S1 of the circle. And it just consists of smooth maps from S1 to S1, and with pointwise multiplication. So this is just a commutative group. And we often write these elements, L tilde of S1, as e to the in, where f is just a periodic function, it's a periodic function on the circle. So I've got g mapping minus pi to pi to r, and g of pi is equal to g of minus pi plus 2n pi, where n is the winding number. So it's a simple object in some sense, but it's quite subtle in others, actually. So it turns out the important thing for us, actually, is the base loop group. So I want to say something about that. So first of all, I can define an inner product on the space of real functions on S1, like this. So there's a natural inner product, sort of equivalent to the trace form. And the base loop group just fixes a point, let's say 1. So 5, 1 is equal to 1. And the corresponding Lie algebra is just functions from S1 to R. which also pictures a point, if you like, where u over 1 is equal to 0. And there's an exponential map, which is a Lie group isomorphism. So that's the Bates loop group plus its Lie algebra. A Lie group isomorphism. The topology are different. That's true. It is a covering map. Yes, I guess maybe isomorphism. Yeah, there are more components. So it's a covering map in that sense. Yeah. So there's a natural 2 co-cycle on L of R, which you could write down like this. And there's a natural central extension of the algebra by R. And so technically you can think of the geometric duals of L of R and its central extension as themselves. So that's just a technical thing, but I want to come back to that in a moment. So the important thing to realize is that oddly enough, the Lie group itself you can think of as a coadjoint orbit. And so if that works in the following way, so if I take a coadjoint orbit at the central extension on L of R, the coadjoint action is an affine action, and it's actually turned out to be this quantity over here. And so the orbit, say, of constant function 0 is equal to L of S1 over S1. And what you can see, basically, sort of skipping the details in some sense, is that the base Lie group is essentially a coadjoint orbit of its natural central extension. That's the beautiful thing. So it's a nice object which you can understand, but it's actually a coadjoint orbit itself. And since it's a coadjoint orbit itself, all this nice technology that we've already had can be applied in the setting. And there are three Riemannian metrics, the normal, the induced, and the Kähler, which you can write down on the loop group. And so the goal here is to see sort of how this these flows that we looked at in the finite dimensional setting extend to this loop group setting. And there's a lot of sort of technology you can write down, but one of the nice things is in order to get the Kähler structure, one needs what's called the Hilbert transform. So how do we see, for example, that it's a Kähler manifold? Well, it turns out that the complex structure is basically the Hilbert transform on the circle. So this is the Hilbert transform, where this interval with a bar here denotes the Cauchy principal value. So it looks sort of fancy, but in fact it's not that hard to write down quite explicitly what the Hilbert transform does. You just think of it as acting on Fourier series. So if I just write down u on the circle in its Fourier series, so sigma n equals minus 1 to n u hat of n e to the in theta, this is what the Hilbert transform does. It just it multiplies it by the sign, basically, of n. So it changes this. And so this follows from this identity, h hat f of n is equal to minus I f hat of n times the sine of n. And I'll show you in a moment that it turns out to be a complex structure. So for example, you can also say that h of u prime is just equal to the sum of mod n u hat of n equal to the I n theta. D squared by d theta squared of a function is equal to that. And d squared d theta squared to the half makes sense and turns out to be equal to h u prime of theta. And that'll come back when I look at gradient flows. So in particular, you can think of h as a unitary operator on L of R. And the Hilbert transform actually has this form here. It basically tells you that h u of theta is equal to minus I, as I said, times u hat of n times sine of n. And it defines the structure of a complex Hilbert space. So if I just take h squared, it's easy to check that h squared is equal to minus the identity. So you can think of h as the I on the loop group. That's the basic thing. And that gives us the complex structure and also the Kähler metric. So you can check, in fact, that it's not only the complex structure, it's actually a Kähler manifold. And if I look at g of 1 uv equals omega of h uv, it's equal to this quantity here, and that defines for me the Kähler metric. Okay, so the loop group has even though it's an infinite dimensional thing, it has a very nice sort of geometric structure, if you like. And that enables us to define these three metrics again. So I won't worry too much about the details here, but you can see, you can basically write down the three metrics that I just mentioned, the Kähler metric, the induced metric, and the normal metric, just by using the sort of this natural pairing, the co-cycle on the algebra, plus this complex structure that comes from the Hilbert transform. So this, the induced metric, is just literally what you think. You just pair the guys together under the integral sign, just like you did in the finite dimensions. And then you can define these two other metrics just by putting in the h, or putting in the derivative. So this turns out to be the equivalent of B2, the Kähler metric, and this turns out to be the equivalent of the normal metric. And you can write down the flows. So you can say something about it. You can check that, you know, that it's bilinear, symmetric. These are, in fact, good metrics. So I won't worry too much about the detail, but you can check that everything is good. And this Riemannian metric that I just described is the normal metric. And you can write it down quite explicitly. So in particular, for example, the Kähler metric turns out to be exactly this quantity here. So again, if you go back to the Fourier series picture, you can write things down very nicely in terms of the Fourier series. So now you can just compute. So I'll sort of omit the details, but basically what we want to do is just do the analogy of what we did in finite dimensions, which is just look at the gradient of the functions on the algebra. And so the natural function to look at is h of I f equals, is essentially the integral of f prime to theta squared. So you can think of that as the energy on the group, basically. And you can compute, and it turned out to be quite explicit in some sense. So for the normal metric, the gradient turns out to be just f e to the I f. With the induced metric, you get minus f double prime e to the I f. And with the Kähler metric, you get h f prime d to the I f. Okay, so these are sort of quite explicit formulations, and you can see that the flow with respect to the sort of metrics is sort of related, basically, I mean, in the Kähler case, by this Hilbert transform. Those are the flows. You can also compute the Hamiltonian vector field. So it's kind of nice to do that, right? Because it's a Kähler manifold. The Hamiltonian and gradient flows are related by the complex structure. So once you've got the gradient flow, you can compute using the complex structure H on the Kähler gradient flow, the Hamiltonian flow, and that just turned out to be minus F prime e to the IF. So these things are quite explicit, which is rather nice. In this case, write down its flow explicitly. So this is actually the flow of the Hamiltonian vector field. Sort of basically, it's a flow which rotates the loops. You can do it a little more generally. So if I just write down a general H, again, you can write down the gradient flow. So again, with respect to the induced metric, it's del H by the U. And these are the flows here for a more general H with respect to the different metrics. So you can do this quite generally, and quite generally also you can look at the sort of Hamiltonian flow as well. If you look at, it turned out to be a little more explicit. If you want to get PDEs, you can look at the flow on the algebra. So instead of looking at the flow on the group, I look at the function L of R to R on the algebra, and I look at the flow on that, and in that case you get very nice explicit PDEs. So for example, for the normal metric you get U, for the induced metric you get U double prime, and for the Kähler metric you get H U prime. So these literally define PDEs. UT equals U, UT equals minus U double prime, UT equals H U prime. So these are sort of the Am I happy with it? It's backward diffusion, of course. It's not well posed, but you can just change the sign, right? So if I take a different, so this is like the direction of positive ascent, right, which is unstable. But yes, if you want to get the downward flow, change the sign, and you get something that's well posed. So as I said, in fact, you do get the heat. So if you change the sign, you get the heat equation. Otherwise, you get backward diffusion. But yeah, so that's certainly a good point. And if I have time, I'll come back to that in the sense of the metroplectic setting. So that's just a technical point. I don't think I'll worry about that too much. And then again, you can look at the Hamiltonian vector field explicitly. So the Hamiltonian vector field just turns out to be xh of u equals minus u primed. So basically, the Hamiltonian vector field is just ut plus ux equal to zero, right? Just the linear PDE. So that's the Hamiltonian counterpart. And so if you add in a few more technical details, you can give a sort of more general result. Which gives it sort of metric the flow on the loop group, but it's essentially the same thing, so I won't worry too much about those details. And again, you can write down the Hamiltonian flow in this more general setting, just with more conditions on H. This is just a remark on what I was saying. You get the flow ut equals minus u double primed. So just a word in the setting again. So this is the flow ut is equal to h u primed. So this has this rather nice form, if you like, minus d squared by d theta squared to the half of u. And this is sort of actually this is what the original inspiration for the work. So this actually appears in the work of Atiyah and Presley, and it's a rather intriguing flow. So we always wondered exactly how this was a gradient flow, and this is how it's a gradient flow. So this is the gradient flow, if you like, with respect to the Kähler metric on the loop group, and you can write it down in this pretty explicit way. Although the interesting thing is, if you go back to the finite dimensional setting where we're on an orbit, it's actually not possible to write down explicitly the flow with respect to the Kähler metric. You can only write down the flow explicitly with respect to the induced metric and the normal metric. As it happens on the loop group, you can write all these things down sort of quite explicitly, which is kind of nice. So. They're beautiful objects. So how much time do I have? Like 5, 10 minutes, or 20 minutes? All right. Well, 20. So, well, I don't want to sort of bore you for too long. So I'll do another 5 or 10 minutes. So let's see how it goes. So I'll come back to finite dimensions in a moment. So the first thing I want to do before going back to finite dimensions. Is just to relate this to some of the things that you know. So we talked about the total lattice, which is an integral system. Actually, these sort of structures and functions here are related to the KdV equation, which is, of course, another integrable system, and itself related to the total lattice, right? It's like the weak dispersion limit of the total lattice. But we know, for example, what the Hamiltonian structure is for the total lattice. It's just this bracket over here, the sort of famous Gardner bracket. And it turns out, basically, that the metrics that we're looking at are more or less sort of the inverse of this Gardner bracket in a certain sense. I just want to show you. So you have the Gardner bracket. ds by du is the usual functional derivative. And so to get the KdV equation, I can just act with a Poisson tensor on del h by dlu, and the Hamiltonian h of u is equal to this thing over here. So that produces the KdV equation. And it has a bunch of Casimirs, which are these things over here. And so in fact, you can show that these Casimirs actually define sort of weak symplectic leads in the phase space. The KdV equation is a nice Hamiltonian system, basically, in all the ways that you'd like to get it. And in fact, but this shows, in fact, that there's a nice relationship with the symplectic form of the complex Hilbert space L of R1. And in fact, you can show that sigma d squared by d theta squared uv is equal to the symplectic form, omega uv. So that relates the metric, if you like, to the symplectic form. And you can think of d by d theta as the minus 1 as the integral of u. And yes, it is, yeah. And the KdV symplectic form, you can sort of rewrite in this sort of suggestive way. It's d by d theta to the minus 1 of u1 inner product u2. And the Poisson bracket given by the Kähler form is equal to this. And it turns out, in fact, that the if you just sort of take that, that the gradient flow, that the gradient flow is actually sort of, well, so if you take this Poisson bracket defined by the Kähler form, this is the Hamiltonian you get, so it's d by d theta inverse of dh by du, so it's just like the inverse of the KdV flow, and if I take the, if I let h act on this, I get the Kähler metric flow. So you remember it was basically, if I had u squared here, it was hut, or hut, u primed rather. So in fact, so if you just take the inverse, so to get the, the gradient flow with respect to the Kähler metric, what you choose, you take the inverse of the symplectic form corresponding to KdV, and you multiply by h. Basically that's it. So it gives you h d by d theta to the minus 1 of the del h by d of u. So I think, yeah. Yeah, so so what kind of functions are in h to the minus a half? I don't know exactly. I don't. Yes. Right. Yeah. Ah, that's a good question. I don't know exactly off the top of my head. Yeah. But anyway, that's the place where things are defined. Yeah. Okay, so I'm sort of, I'm going to end off though, coming back to, maybe I'll get to infinite dimensional systems, but I want to say something about metrophasic systems in general, I'll start at finite dimensional. Yes. No. Yeah. Well, I don't. I mean, it's certainly, you know, it's got this nice sort of soliton-like behavior. So that's a good question. I don't know for a fact that KdV is a gradient flow. On the other hand, the dispersionist total lattice flow is a gradient flow. So I'll come back to that. So this is the flow that I wrote down earlier. U bracket Z, with these are the standard Poisson brackets. And this is something. This is like the flow UTT equals E. I think it's e to the theta. See, can I do this off the top of my head? No, as far as I know, it's not known. So that's sort of the weak. So KdV is the weakly nonlinear limit of TODA. This thing over here, which you can write as a set of coupled ODEs in the form of PDEs, UT and VT, this is a gradient flow in a suitable metric. And that's like the strongly nonlinear limit of TODA. So in fact, there is a version which is gradient when you just shrink the lattice spacing to zero. But that limit doesn't give you KdV. It gives you the so-called dispersionist TODA equation. All right. So I want to say something about metroplectic systems. So this goes back to work of Morrison, who many of you know, and it's related to this work that Tudor and I did with Jerry on dissipation-induced instabilities. So a metroplectic system is a system where you basically have a Hamiltonian piece plus a gradient piece. And you can try and fit them together in various ways. One way that does it in a very tight and nice fashion, and it sort of describes the entropy associated with the system, are these so-called metroplectic systems. So the idea is you have a Poisson bracket and a symmetric bracket, basically. So that a system on a manifold, P star P, is a Hamiltonian, there's a Poisson bracket, there's a symmetric bracket, but in addition, there are these two conditions which relate the two brackets, which is if you take the entropy, the entropy is actually a Casimir for the Poisson bracket, and the Hamiltonian is a Casimir, if that's the right word, for the symmetric bracket. So it commutes with every function under the symmetric bracket. So basically the Hamiltonian and the entropy kind of leave each other alone. It sort of dissipates the entropy, but it sort of leaves the Hamiltonian alone. So that's sort of a rather beautiful structure which describes entropy in various systems. And so the metroplectic dynamics of the system can be written basically like this. So it's Ft basically equals F bracket H plus F bracket S, or you could think of some bigger bracket which combines H plus S, and I get a sort of nice PDE, at least a nice ODE out of this, or you can extend this to PDEs as well. And so you can check things you know, a number of properties that it has. For example, it does give you energy conservation because you have a Hamiltonian plus a Casimir piece. You have entropy production. D by dt of S is equal to the inner product of S, comma S. And there's an additional thing that you can get here, that the maximum entropy principle that yields equilibrium. I think I'll skip that for the moment. So those are the basic ideas. And you end up with this nice system which combines Hamiltonian pieces and dissipative pieces. And it sort of, as it turns out, to describe a number of sort of physical systems of interest. So I just want to describe one thing that we've been looking at. So here's a system. It's a general theory, and you might wonder how you construct the brackets in this case. I just want to show you a nice way of, in fact, constructing a metric eclectic system. So these are metric eclectic systems based on Lie algebra, triple brackets. The triple brackets go back to the work of Nambu, which some of you might know. So there's a natural triple bracket lying around, and you can use it both to give a sort of Hamiltonian piece of the dynamics and a gradient flow. And the way to do it is to pair things up in the right way using the Killing form. So here's the Killing form in coordinates. K of ij is equal to CPij CQJP, where these are the structure coefficients of the Lie algebra. And you can use that to sort of construct for yourself a symmetric bracket. So let's kappa be the Killing form, and I'm going to construct a three tensor, a completely anti-symmetric covariant three tensor out of the Killing form, and it looks a little bit just like the Kostin-Kirillov form. So I just take three elements in the algebra, psi, eta, and zeta, and I pair them under the Killing form in a natural way. So it's kappa of psi, the bracket of eta and zeta. Okay, and that's clearly completely anti-symmetric. You can just check if you just put those things around, I get something that's completely skewed. And I'm going to use that to construct both a sort of Hamiltonian piece and a non-Hamiltonian piece. So as I said, this leads to the triple bracket formulation of dynamics, if you like. So this goes back to this paper of Bialnicki, Barilla, and Morrison in 1991, although they didn't quite write it like this. But in any case, you take this bracket, so I write a bracket, FGH, a triple bracket, which is C of grad F, grad G, grad H, which is exactly kappa of grad F, grad G, grad H. So it's a completely skew bracket on the gradient of F. So that's it. That's a triple bracket. So the gradient is just taken in the usual way. All right. Yeah, it's essentially the Nambu bracket. The Nambu bracket, yeah, so certainly it's quoted. So, yeah, the history, I'm not sure they wrote it exactly like this on a Lie algebra, but I mean, so the general setting, I would claim, is 91. So in R3, I'll come back to this, it's a very simple thing. It's just del F dot del G cross del H. That's it. That's the Nambu bracket. So which is an intriguing object. You might wonder what you can do with it. It turns out you can do kind of nice things with it. I guess I made that remark.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry.
Yeah. So that's it. All right. And then and at this point I wanted to make this connection, as I mentioned earlier. So here's a modified bracket, and modified brackets, as I said earlier, we didn't know about Nambu, but when we looked at the stabilization of the rigid body, the brackets that we used to keep the system Hamiltonian were exactly these modified brackets. So it's a slightly special case of Nambu. Similar things appear in Home and Mars, and I'm not sure if you knew about Nambu or not at that point, to be honest. I don't know, but anyway. And there's actually a problem in the book of Mars and Ratchu where they asked you to think about these brackets. It really is a fun bracket to think about, and in fact, in R3, it really is a Poisson bracket. But in general, if you go to higher dimensions, the one I wrote down, it doesn't generally give you a plus on a bracket. You have to be quite careful about when you're really getting real brackets out of this or not. But in any case, you can write down Hamiltonian flows. So let me just show you those. So I want to specialize it. So I take this quadratic function of half kappa of psi psi, which is a Casimir function for the Lie Poisson bracket, and you can check that I can write down, say, the Lie Poisson bracket in terms of the Nambu bracket like this. So F comma G plus is just C2 F bracket G. So a particular choice of one of those functions in the triple bracket leads you to the Lie Poisson bracket, which I think is kind of cute. So, and this is what it is in SO3. So FG SO3 minus is equal to minus that. That's the Lie Poisson bracket. And of course, out of that, I can get the rigid body dynamics of the suitable Hamiltonian. So that's sort of, so there is a particular Hamiltonian side. But in fact, I also would like to get a gradient piece. So I'm going to do that in a moment. So given any two functions, well, you can check, yeah, so you can check that you get a sort of gradient, you can get a feel. So even if you don't write down the bracket, you can check that you get a flow, which I'll call FXFGH, out of the triple bracket. So that's, so since the Leibniz identity, et cetera, is satisfied, I can end up quite generally with a flow, which I'm going to use to construct the gradient flow in a moment. So this is what the vector field looks like in general. So XFH comma psi is equal to grad F comma bracket grad G, all right? Which is it's a really nice flow, and it's a well-defined flow, but it's not necessarily a Hamiltonian flow in general, okay? And you can see that why it's probably not Hamiltonian, because so a Hamiltonian thing should look like psi bracket something, which makes a tangent to the orbit. So this is really an interesting object in general. It's something that has both a peak that's tangent to an orbit and may go perpendicular to the orbit. Now, and this is sort of the thing that I'll end up with in a way. So now you want to, so I'd like to construct now a symmetric bracket. Well, it turns out you can construct a symmetric bracket just by combining two of these fields together under the trace. So if I take kappa of that vector field I just showed you, and I pair them together, I get a nice symmetric bracket, and it turns out to give you a metroplectic system. And in fact, the metroplectic system is a rather beautiful system. This is it. So if I choose the Casimir as the right way to make it absolutely Hamiltonian, I get a Lie Poisson piece over here, and I get this double bracket form over here. So it's exactly the double bracket form that I showed you earlier. With a little twist, I have a grad H over here. So the double bracket I showed you earlier, L bracket N, is just psi bracket grad. This has the gradient there as well. And so this turns out to be a nice metroplectic system. You can construct various examples. And let me just, so I'll show you an example in SO3 just to end up with, I think. So that's SO3. Let me just show you a couple of explicit examples. So for example, you can use it to construct the double bracket dissipation, which you call BKMR, which looks like this in R3. So that's exactly what appeared in our original paper in theory. And if I just restrict it, let's see. So let me just, so specializing this all the way to the following. So if I restrict myself to R3, I take H equal to half pi squared and S equal to C dot pi. So this goes back exactly to what I had earlier. So this is like the Toda Hamiltonian, pi squared. C dot pi is like trace ln. Then the flow just turns out to be pi dot equals C cross pi minus pi cross C, which is exactly a Hamiltonian piece, like for the rigid body, plus this double bracket dissipation. And you can flip things around. If I just take S, if I take the entropy to be half pi squared and H equal to C dot pi, so I just interchange them, I get this flow here. So the Hamiltonian piece remains the same, and I get C cross pi, which is also dissipation, and it's also a rather beautiful kind of dissipation. This is the sort of dissipation you often get in quantum mechanical systems. So this is a dissipation which is also double bracket, but it's linear double bracket, because C is fixed. So it's linear in pi as opposed to quadratic in pi, and this is something, so the other one, so the first thing, the double bracket dissipation preserves orbits, but the second one doesn't preserve orbits. But it turns out you can get both out of this metroplectic structure. And this all generalizes, actually, interestingly enough, to PDEs as well. You can just write down a completely anti-symmetric tensor on the space of fields and so on, and you get all sorts of nice PDE examples, including, again, either the backwards or the forwards heat equation. It turned out also to be, follow exactly from like a symmetric triple bracket of this Nambu form. So anyway, so the metroplectic structure seems to contain all these things in a very nice way, although I have to say, to be honest, that there's some sort of couple PDE systems which have dissipation and Hamiltonian pieces which are not metroplectic, but anyway, they're still sort of interesting. All right, I'll stop there. Yes. Right, I think so. So in this case, sort of on the sphere, though. I mean, this one preserves the orbit. Yeah, exactly, like that. And this one sort of goes into the interior of the sphere. So this, the lower one, because that doesn't preserve the orbit.
0.51.
Yeah, exactly. So that doesn't preserve. The top one preserves the sphere. The bottom one doesn't. The top, yeah, the bottom one does not conserve it, but the top one does. Yeah, the standard version, yeah.
Yeah, I see.
I mean, there's also a nice connection with this with quantum mechanics. So if you think of the sphere as the Bloch sphere, then you know Hamiltonian mechanics is, you know, pure Hamiltonian mechanics is on the Bloch sphere. But if you connect it to a heat bath, that you get these so-called master equations, and a certain class of master equations looks exactly like that. So you get sort of external dissipation, which actually sort of kills the orbit. So you move into the interior of the Bloch sphere. Yeah, and so in fact our framework is more, yeah, so you can generalize, right, the metroplectic is special and, yeah, I don't know. So the metroplectic, though, as we discussed, I guess, a very special condition, and one doesn't always need it. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Casimir dissipation is
energy.
Yeah. Or energy dissipation.
A constant. Right. So that's exactly. So this yields. So exactly, choosing that general metroplectic formulation and putting in the Casimir dissipation yields exactly that. So that's a special case, I would claim, of those generalized Nambu brackets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And there is a double bracket. Okay. All right.
Thank you.